The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Affordable Care Act, the Supreme Court, the Paris Agreement, those are among the questions of what kinds of changes a Trump administration will bring. And to that, we add a far less critical one, White House decor. Each incoming president is expected to make the executive mansion home. But how far can an incoming president go in putting their mark on the White House, an historic place that many traditionally feel belongs to the American people, not the family that lives there?
I hate to make changes, really. So when you find a room like this, it's wonderful.
That is First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy from a televised tour of the recently renovated White House in 1962. The special was broadcast on all three major networks and gave the public its first view of the $2 million renovation. 80 million Americans watched the program, and it was syndicated throughout the world. First families have a lot of leeway for living quarters on the top two floors of the 132-room executive mansion. And there have been some famous and infamous large-scale changes since the Kennedy makeover, which included the Rose Garden and a swimming pool. President Richard Nixon built a one-lane bowling alley below a driveway. Jimmy and Rosalind Carter wanted to save money, so they skipped the standard redesign of the earth-toned Oval Office. Instead, Carter installed solar panels, which Ronald Reagan quickly removed. President Obama added a basketball court, and First Lady Michelle Obama put in a garden. We called Edward Langle, chief historian of the White House Historical Association, to find out what is permitted and whether the new president gets a moving allowance, like a lot of people do if they accept a job in another city.
Yes, they get a certain endowment from Congress to cover moving and to cover a certain degree of redecoration.
How much?
It varies from president to president. Mary Todd Lincoln back in the 1860s got, as I recall, $20,000, which she notoriously overspent, and it has gone up, of course, since then with inflation.
So how many rooms need to be furnished when a new president moves in?
Well, they will certainly refurnish the family living rooms. There are several of those. They will refurnish the state and family dining rooms. They will also, to some degree, refurnish the entrance hall as well as other rooms in the house. But the number that they actually work on depends on the inclination of the president and the first lady, as the case may be.
And these furnishings, do they get to keep them? I mean, maybe it sounds silly, but will the Obamas take the curtains or rugs and towels with them?
They can't do that anymore. It used to be in the 19th century, it was much more common for incoming and outgoing presidents either to change things willy-nilly, to even throw things out, or occasionally to take things with them. Sometimes they even sold items of furniture while they were president in order to earn money to buy new furniture. That is no longer possible. The furniture that's in the collection now is protected, as the White House has national landmark status, and the items in the White House, the furniture and the more permanent furnishings are all part of the collection. So they can't simply be carried off.
So I'm thinking about things that I associate with the White House. I've seen this photographs of a Steinway piano, for example, the George Washington portrait painted by Gilbert Stuart. So are these things that stay in the White House? They don't get moved around?
There are certain fixtures, like especially the George Washington portrait, that are pretty much always there and always in the same place, although presidents have occasionally changed the portrait to a different George Washington portrait. For example, since the Kennedy administration, there's been a portrait of Abraham Lincoln over the fireplace in the state dining room. But for the most part, there's so much furniture there already in the White House that the presidents really don't have any room to take in much of their own. The Obamas, for example, left all of their furniture in Chicago when they came in. So they may do things like change the color scheme of individual rooms. For example, the state dining room used to be a very dark paneled old Victorian decor. Teddy Roosevelt had even put animal heads up on the walls, so like elk and moose and bear. But after Truman came in, he decided he needed to lighten it up, so he changed the color scheme, changed the decorations.
And as to Teddy's trophies, Jackie Kennedy shared another take. Apparently, they were not universally admired.
Theodore Roosevelt hung his stuffed animal heads around the room. There's a story that President Wilson so disliked these stuffed heads that he always seated himself in such a manner that he would not see them while dining.
The Trump administration is sure to bring a lot of changes, among them White House decor. Edward Lengel is chief historian of the White House Historical Association. He's talking about how other first families have put their mark on the executive mansion over the years. Historically, it's often the first lady that plays a great role in designing or redesigning the White House. And Melania Trump has said that she will not move into the White House in January so their son can finish the school year in New York City. So where does the First Lady fall into this redecoration or redesign?
Traditionally, First Ladies have played a major role both inside and outside the White House. And for example, the First Ladies since Edith Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's wife in 1904, have played a major role in redesigning the White House gardens. Ellen Wilson, Woodrow Wilson's wife, changed that and installed a lily pond. Lady Bird Johnson redesigned the East Garden and named it after Jackie Kennedy, and she, of course, created the Rose Garden in 1962. So they've had a major role there. They have also, for example, when the first family enters the White House, the chief usher of the White House will typically take the family, including the First Lady, all over the building and show them where things are, how they've been designed, where furniture is stored, and we'll work with the First Lady to change color schemes, to change arrangements. So that'll be a big change for a First Lady not to be involved in that, as apparently will be the case.
The Obama family's renovations were praised for their design aesthetic, and they were featured in Architectural Digest. Are there any other first families that really hit it out of the park?
It's been changed profoundly since the very beginning. The Lincolns certainly hit it out of the park. They had encountered a White House that had become profoundly run down over the previous decades, many decades of neglect. Mary Todd Lincoln, as I mentioned earlier, spent a lot of money to refurbish it. She brought in a laminated mahogany bedroom suite, including the Lincoln bed that's still there today. Chester Arthur in 1882 created this big 338-foot Tiffany mosaic screen in the entrance hall, which sadly is lost. It was apparently a beautiful piece of work. But in modern memory, the family that did the most was clearly the Trumans. When Harry Truman came in after FDR died in World War II, there really wasn't much time. He didn't have much time to make any changes. But the White House had become so decayed by that point that the chief usher said it looked like an abandoned hotel, and he gutted the whole building. He and Bess Truman completely redesigned the interior. Much of what we see today in the White House is indeed a creation of the Truman family.
How about decorating missteps? I mean, you mentioned Mary Todd Lincoln spending a lot of money. Did that become an issue?
That was an issue at the time in terms of the amount of money that she spent. It wasn't exactly what I would call a misstep. Certainly, there was such a rage for tacking on things to the White House in the early 20th century that it created a number of structural problems. The Calvin Coolidge administration in the 1920s installed a third floor as well as solarium. The weight of that created so many structural issues that it caused floors and walls to sag, and was one of the reasons the whole thing had to be torn up again just 20 years later.
I'm actually doing a home renovation project myself, so I'm curious any about other home improvements undertaken by First Families, you know, real building construction besides Calvin Coolidge.
Well, of course, Teddy Roosevelt created the West Wing. Teddy was such a fascinating president in so many ways, but one of the things that he changed was he shifted the White House from being more purely a working space to a family space. He was so family-oriented. He was notorious for turning the White House into a huge playroom. He would go racing up and down the halls with his children. Part of the reason he had the West Wing built and he expanded the family living areas was so that he could create a more home and family-friendly space. And then his successor, William Howard Taft, installed the Oval Office in 1909. Those are some of the major changes, but some have been controversial. The last exterior change was again by Harry Truman. At the end of his renovation, he created a balcony over the South Portico that was so controversial that he couldn't get a bequest of money from Congress for it, so he used money from the household budget to build it.
Well, we've heard a lot of jokes circulating that Trump is going to gild the ceilings, mirror the walls, you know, make them look like one of his hotels. Any real sense of how he'll make the White House his own?
We've even had suggestions from people that he might want to change the color of the White House to some other color. There's clearly a lot of wonderment about what's going to happen. The White House, as it stands now, has got such a beautiful and amazing collection of historic interior decoration that it would be impossible to plunder that or to replace it profoundly with some other items that are non-historical. I would be shocked if he would attempt to, for example, build a major new addition to the White House. It simply would be very structurally difficult and incredibly expensive.
Well, let's leave the last word to a great tastemaker, Jackie Kennedy, who clearly did not equate the presidency with good taste.
That's the oldest thing in the White House, the only thing that was here since the very beginning. The government set a rather interesting precedent when that picture was painted. They commissioned the finest living artist of the day to paint the president. Then they gave it as a gift to the White House. I often wish they'd followed that, because so many pictures of later presidents are by really inferior artists.
Thanks to Edward Langle, chief historian of the White House Historical Association and author of several books, including First Entrepreneur, How George Washington Built His and the Nation's Prosperity. Election 2016 was a bitter slog, and while many Americans looked forward to the end of the ads and mailers and campaign rhetoric, that bitterness did not simply dissipate once the results came in. In the days of street protests and spike in hate crimes that followed, many Americans searched for signs of hope or messages of comfort, and some found them underground. Activists in New York City encouraged commuters to post notes on subway platforms. Soon the walls were covered with colorful squares scribbled with positive messages like grit or love, or offering post-election encouragement like you belong here or do yoga. Others more philosophical. It is a big project of small gestures called Subway Therapy, and it's since spread to Boston, thanks to my guest. Vanita Subramanian is a user experience designer and an urban activist. And Vanita, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So how'd you get things started? Did you seed some of your own little messages to get it going?
So Subway Therapy Boston started as a last-minute project on one Friday afternoon, and quite honestly, we did not expect the overwhelming response that we received. In an effort to keep things positive after the elections, a bunch of friends and I mobilized to provide a medium for the people of Boston to just come together and share words of love and encouragement. This, as you mentioned, was inspired by a similar effort in New York. And what we did was we headed to two busy subway stations and offered riders a simple proposition, which is write a positive message on a post-it note and, well, just post it. So in just 8 hours, we received over 2,500 posts of love to the community, which to me was quite overwhelming. The notes range from personal messages, admiration for Boston, to inspiring quotes from political leaders from around the world. And what was surprising to me was that 99% of all of the notes that we received, it stayed positive, with exception to maybe 4 or 5 notes.
Wow, that really is something. Out of how many do you imagine?
Like 2,500 something notes. So that was, you know, it was crazy. And participants were, any of hate messages that they saw, they quickly transformed it into something inspiring or quirky. And now what we're doing with the help of volunteers is archiving all of the notes and uploading it to our website. So we have 200 up there so far. And with the help of our volunteers, I hope we can get as many as possible.
Were any stick out as favorites for you, you know, that really made you think?
There were so many of them, and one that caught my attention is reach out to someone you disagree with, because, you know, every now and then we need to challenge what we believe in, and that was something that really resonated with me. Some of the other ones that were admiration for Boston made me feel so proud that I'm part of this community, and I actually moved to this city about 3 years back, and it's been one of, you know, the best decisions of my life.
So why the subway, Vanita? I mean, what is it about that space that makes it work?
I think it's because you meet people from all walks of life when you commute, and you don't see that very often. You know, when you look at a private space, I've met some Trump supporters. I met people who were just visiting Boston. I met all sorts of people, like high schoolers and, you know, college students. So it's just a place where everybody needs to take the train to go home, and, you know, they stop by, read the messages on the wall, and, you know, feel the urge to contribute.
Well, it's interesting because this is something that people do on other people's Facebook walls, you know, post something, some little message. How is it different?
It's different because I feel like we're always in this virtual realm, that it's nice to just, you know, take the time off and have some in-person time with one another. Like, I met a lot of people through this project, and I know a lot of strangers who started voicing their opinions out with other, you know, people who also stopped by to admire the project. But it was a place where people could just unknowingly share their thoughts, and in some way it is therapeutic, you know, a way of self-expression. And I think that's why it's unique. Like, having a community engagement projects, in my mind, is more unique and engaging as opposed to also having it online, which I think is a plus. So what we're doing now is to have these messages reach a larger audience through our website. So I think, you know, having both an in-person sort of engagement process as well as having something online has its benefits.
So do you think it's, you said, therapeutic for the reader, for the writer, both?
I'd say for both. You know, there were people who came and who participated who were basically in tears. You know, they were just reading the messages on the wall and they just started crying. And I was like, wow, this actually has such an inspiring effect on so many people. And then they came up to us because we were handing out posters and, you know, just thanking us, saying that this, you know, I needed this. You know, I feel like there was just so much negativity in the air, and I just reading these messages makes me feel like I need to do something positive and I need to keep thinking positively. So I think it was therapeutic for both the reader and the writer.
But it's, you know, it's a country that's facing some very big decisions and divisions.
Yep.
So, you know, somebody might say, oh, post-it note, that's a very small gesture. You know, mm-hmm. What are your hopes for a project like this?
You know, I was equally surprised because it was such a small gesture, and it's like a collective impact that you can have. I guess if you just see one post-it note with a message on it, you know, you'd read it, you'd think to yourself that, okay, that's a sweet message. But if you see thousands of messages on one wall and 99% of that being positive, that should have some effect on anyone reading it, regardless of, you know, what political affiliations you have. You know, it's just a human gesture at the end of the day.
Well, Vanita, thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
Vanita Subramanian, she's a user experience designer, urban activist, and founder of the Subway Therapy Project Boston. You'll find a link to the website where you can see some of the post-it notes from the wall at the Boston Tea at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, here with another installment of the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop with Tom Gauld. He's a cartoonist and an illustrator of comics and covers for The New Yorker and The Believer. His weekly cartoon about the arts for The Guardian newspaper is a wry, often deadpan favorite among writers. He's been extremely prolific, author of more than a dozen books of comics, including You're Just Jealous of My Backpack, and more recently, Moon Cop. I met with Tom before his talk at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
I'm Tom Gauld, and this is the 10 Minutes Writer's Workshop.
How do you begin, with an image or an idea?
It could be either, actually. Although I suppose an image is an idea. So I suppose it does start as an idea, which is perhaps neither a picture or some words. And then I try and capture that idea in my sketchbook with a mixture of drawing and writing. And I get as much as I can into the sketchbook, and then hopefully the whole thing grows out of those sketchy doodles and notes.
So how much plotting and planning do you do before you start, or does it happen sort of as you're doing it?
Well, it's tricky with comics because it is you are writing with two different languages, the language of words and the language of pictures. So I tend to have a few different notebooks on the go, one where I'm writing script, almost like a movie script, and then another one where I'm designing the sets and the objects and the characters. And then a third one where I'm making very rough page layouts and trying to think how the story will look on the page. And I try and work on them all simultaneously because I think comics are about all three of those things.
Do you share your work ever with anyone else before you hand it in?
Never with the short cartoons. I think if I started doing that, I'd start second guessing and editing myself and looking at people to see if they were laughing enough. And I think I'd get into knots with that. But with Moon Cop and the other book I wrote, Goliath, I wrote a first draft and then had a few trusted people read it. Because I think with a longer thing, there's more to kind of keep your eye on, and it's good to have somebody else checking it over.
What's your best environment for doing your work?
I have a studio where I go to work every day, and I'm a morning person, so I like to get started nice and early and try and draw some cartoons as soon as I can. And if I get stuck there, I'll take a walk, go to a coffee shop, and work in my sketchbook there. And I think that combination of a change of surroundings, some caffeine, and some movement almost always has some good effect on what I'm working on.
What's your worst distraction from getting your work done?
My worst habit is putting things aside when they're not working and not pushing on through it. And so I guess the distractions are the things which I really could leave till later. I sort of think with my cartoons, most of the other things, the admin, the replying to emails, all those things, I can do them anytime. And I always tell myself I should push them away, and when I'm ready to work, just do the work.
Do you work? You said you get up in the morning and start. Do you have certain rituals and a schedule of I have to work X amount of hours, that kind of thing?
Not really. I mean, the important thing is getting started. If I come in and I start answering emails straight away, then that can totally spoil things. So I try and get started, get drawing, and start making things, just doodling in my sketchbook as quickly as I can.
So you write your own comics as well as, you know, not everybody does that. Some people just illustrate them, work with a colorist. You do it all by yourself. And you seem to have a lot of empathy for writers. Where did that come from?
I think they're quite similar things, making cartoons, even being an illustrator and being a writer. It's something you generally do on your own, quietly. It's not a terribly glamorous process. It's not like making a movie when there's loads of people around and it looks exciting. It's just a person sitting quietly at a desk, moving their hands a little.
Is there a work or something that you saw that made you think, I want to be a cartoonist, that's what I want?
Yes. When I discovered the works of Edward Gorey, I was at college in Edinburgh, and at that time I was just making illustrations for other people's texts. And I found some of his books in the college library, and they did just switch a light on in my head, and I thought, I can make picture stories, I can tell stories with words and pictures, and they don't have to be like anyone else's. They don't have to follow all the rules of comics.
What was the first thing that you ever submitted to be published?
Well, I began when I left college working as an illustrator, but as well as showing my illustration work, I'd always show people some of my self-published comic books. And so it was Time Out magazine in London asked me, I went in to see them about doing some illustration work, but I said I also did comics. And they asked me quite quickly, actually, to do a weekly cartoon for them, which was absolutely terrifying.
What was the best advice you ever received from anybody about doing creative work, specifically to writing or to drawing comics or illustrating?
I think I don't know who said it, but there was somebody who said that writing is just about showing up at the desk. It's a bit of a cliche, but I was thinking about this. I think 90% of making a comic book is just persuading yourself to press on with it, to accept what you've done and make more of it and push on through till the end.
How about the worst advice? Were you ever told something about how you should do the work that just felt like, no, that proved to be wrong?
Yeah, no, actually, I can think of that straight away. The Guardian, the newspaper I work for, quite often asks writers for their advice. And quite often my cartoons are related to that advice. And there was a British playwright who said, never write unless you have something important to say, which I just thought, maybe if you're really a confident person full of opinions, that's a great piece of advice. But I think most writers are constantly worried that what they have to say isn't worthwhile. And I think you just have to try saying it and hopefully something will come together.
Do you have a fantasy job other than a cartoonist?
I don't know. I think as a kid I'd have thought being an astronaut would be rather fun. But I sort of realized you're sort of being a robot in space. You're kind of doing what you're told all day long, and I'm not sure I'd like that. I sometimes fantasize about being a baker. When I was at college, I had a part-time job working in a pie shop, and I really enjoyed that. So maybe if it all gets too much one day, I'll open a bakery.
So did you live out any of your astronaut-like fantasies creating Moon Cop?
Yeah, I think Moon Cop was... quite a lot of it was inspired by childhood fantasies. The facts of the space race and technology, which I was kind of excited by as a nerdy kid, and the fiction of things like Star Wars and some of the sci-fi comics I was reading. And in a way, Moon Cop is inspired by those childish things and the fact that they are slightly childish, some of those views of space and of science kind of plays into the story.
And you got to design, create all of those fantastic buildings that populate the moon.
Yeah, well, I want, whenever I make a comic, I want it to be a believable setting. It doesn't have to be realistic, but it needs to, on its own level, be convincing, to have a sort of internal logic. So I spend quite a lot of time thinking about how things would work, and that may not appear in the comic in the forefront, but I think the fact that good thinking is under there helps the story.
Tom Gold, thank you so much for walking around Cambridge and finding a quiet spot.
Thank you.
Cartoonist Tom Gold there, joining me for our 10-Minute Writers Workshop podcast. This episode was produced by Sarah Plourd, and you can listen to more author interviews by subscribing to the 10-Minute Writers Workshop on iTunes, Google Play, and NPR One. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear and Jason Leonard. And here's a little nugget before we go. Merriam-Webster, the dictionary publisher, tweeted this week that fascism is well on its way to becoming the most looked-up word of the year. And on Wednesday, practically begged users, please, there's still time to look something else up. Anything but this. Maybe you've got a better idea. Tweet it to us at Word of Mouth. We're also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.